Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films Maria by Callas, Free Solo, The Other Side of the Wind, and They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. That's a book. Hi, David. The whole titles.
Hi, yeah. Joe. How are you doing this week?
Thick book. Anyway, did you like any of them?
Today we have a theme with all those titles, and the theme is documentary, although one of these is actually a sort of a mock documentary, and in various ways it's really the most important of all these movies, but we'll get to that in a moment. So I'd like to start out by talking a little bit about Maria by Callas. This is a documentary, not surprisingly, about the very great opera singer Maria Callas. The movie was directed by Tom Wolfe. And Callas is perhaps the most legendary, at least female opera singer of all time. I suppose Enrico Caruso is the most famous male opera singer. But Callas was a fabulously famous and fabulously celebrated back in the days when opera had more glamour than it has nowadays. She also was probably the original greatest template for the legendary prima donna, the singer who has to be pampered and treated exactly right, or anything could happen. And this is a documentary about her, and it's a very, very nicely made documentary, very interesting, and I think fairly even-handed. It certainly captures the great legend of Callas, but it also gets into her prima donna qualities. It makes a case for her. It's very sympathetic toward her, but it sort of very much shows you what the dark side was. So she was American completely, and she was of Greek ancestry and lived in Greek for part of her earlier part of her life. And she trained in opera, and she always claimed that she really never had any choice. She was sort of steered into becoming a diva when her mother recognized that she had a talent for this. And so she was trained, and of course she had tremendous discipline and all of that. And she did in fact become an internationally celebrated opera star, and eventually other things too. When her voice started to get a bit wobbly a little bit later on, she turned to acting. She had always thought it might be interesting to try acting, and she worked with some pretty great film directors. Not very often, but a little bit. She made, for example, a film of Medea with the great Italian director Pier Paolo Pasolini. And he appears briefly in the movie and archive footage and so forth. And we also get all kinds of things about her private life, her marriage, her first husband, and then her husband, I should say. And then she got hooked up with Aristotle Onassis, and they were a couple for quite a long while, even though they couldn't get officially married because of all the sort of things about rules and laws and religion and whatnot. And then, of course, Aristotle Onassis famously got hooked up with Jacqueline Kennedy, which Callas apparently found out by reading about in the newspapers, and then that was over, and then later on she and Onassis became friends again. So we have all of this, and we have really in this film a very nice and balanced blend of the personal and the professional. We get Callas's career and also a whole lot about her personal life. We have some of the other scandals that involved her, not just romantic kind of stuff. There was a very famous performance when she was performing in Bellini's Norma, and she didn't feel she could go on because she wasn't feeling well, and people accused her of, and the president of Italy was in the audience, and she was accused of just, again, being a prima donna and choosing not to continue the performance, and this caused a big scandal in opera circles that then spilled over into the regular news, and she became kind of notorious for that sort of thing. Eventually, in the last part of her life, she was living pretty much, I guess, in isolation in Paris, and she died of a heart attack when she was only 53 years told. So this, again, the movie is a very, very balanced account of this. Of course, Callis is long dead, so we only see her in archive footage, but we do see a lot of her talking on television and other public venues, and we get a lot of other people speaking about her. And it's a very nicely done documentary. If you have any interest in opera, which I definitely do, you should not miss it. And if you're just interested in the kind of celebrities of the middle part of the 20th century, it's pretty revealing on that score as well. So our next film now has a title which may make you think that I'm going to continue talking about opera and music, because the second film I want to talk about is called Free Solo. But this is actually about mountain climbing. And for me, being an acrophobe, and I do not deal very well with heights, I do not like to be in high places. I do not even particularly like to be standing on a chair to change my clock at daylight savings time. This, for me, is a horror movie. But I love this kind of film because, and I went out of my way to see this, you know, on a nice, pretty big screen. Because for me, I just sit there and I tremble and I quake and I think how glad I'm not up there on that rock with that guy. And I think even people who are not acrophobes, even people who enjoy heights, will sometimes find themselves sort of quivering when they watch the action on the screen here. The main character of this documentary is a guy named Alex Hunold, and he was the first person ever to climb the famous El Capitan Wall, basically a vertical wall at the Yosemite National Park, and he's got 3,000 feet to scale here, and the thing is, this is what's the kind of climbing that is called free solo climbing, which is to say, the guy has got no equipment. The guy has got no safety ropes or any kind of ropes. The guy has got none of those little things that you hammer into the rock face and then hook a rope on and pull yourself up. Nothing, nothing, nothing. What he does have is a pair of shoes, and he has a little cup of a chalk or something hanging off his back so he can dip his fingers into that from time to time and get better traction on the rock. But basically, he is hauling himself up, pulling himself up by putting his fingers and feet into these teensy little bitsy crevices in the rock face and going up 3,000 feet that way. And we watch him do that in extremely graphic footage that was taken. My secret pleasure in watching this movie, that is something I really enjoyed. One of the camera operators seems to be unable to look into his viewfinder, which is on the ground, and it's aimed up at the climber, Alex Hunold, way up there on the rock face, because he's just squirming too much. You know, it's too much for him. So anyway, that's what it's all about. And of course, I wish we found out more in the documentary about exactly how the camera people do operate, because there's a lot of footage of him, which is very, very close in, and you're wondering where exactly those people are. And in fact, part of the documentary does deal with the fact that if the camera people get into his line of sight, they can distract him, and that can be dangerous, so they have to stay outside his line of sight. We have not only this great climb. This movie is, it's more than an hour and a half long, and we see a whole lot about his private life and his girlfriend and how she responds to his doing these unbelievably dangerous things all the time. She becomes a climber herself when she gets involved with him, but she's not at his level. Almost nobody is at his level. And we meet some other climbers, and we find out their comments about him and what a great climber he is. But mainly, we have his preparations for and then his eventual execution of this fantastic climb, which takes him just a few hours. But it's absolutely hair-raising if you're like me, and it's probably hair-raising if you're not like me and you love heights. I really enjoyed this movie. And by the way, it's turned into quite a hit on the documentary circuit, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about it when the awards season comes around. So we now get up to our sort of fake documentary or mockumentary, although it was made before that term was the kind of very current term that it has become in subsequent years. And this is the most important of all the films we're talking about today, because it was directed by one of the greatest filmmakers who have ever lived, Orson Welles. The Other Side of the Wind is a movie that he shot in the first half of the 1970s, roughly from 1970 to 1976. And then he was not able to finish it because, as happened with many, many, many of his productions over the course of his life and career. He just kept running out of money. So he shot this over a period of several years, kept running out of money, and eventually had to stop it. And then he returned to it in the early 1980s, and he started editing the footage that he had shot. And he only edited a few scenes. But he left enormous numbers of notes about what he wanted the final film to be. And the other, and then recently, in 2018, other filmmakers have gotten together and using the footage that he shot, using the footage that he edited, and using the copious notes that he left behind, have finished the film for him. So we have this movie that Orson Welles himself stopped working on in the early 80s, and then he subsequently died. And we now have, all these years later, in 2018, other people have finished the film. And so what we have is a brand new Orson Welles film years and years after his death. Now, this is so important because Orson Welles is one of the greatest filmmakers who just ever lived. Of course, he's most famous for Citizen Kane back in 1941. And then his career started to slide right after that because, as many people don't know, Citizen Kane, regarded by many people as the greatest American film ever made, by some people as the greatest film ever made anywhere, lost money when it first came out. And that did not please the studio, RKO. And so when Orson Welles left the country after completing his second film, completing it but not editing it. His second film was The Magnificent Ambersons in 1942. When he left the country to work on his third film, the studio mutilated The Magnificent Ambersons. They took out tremendous amounts of footage, threw it away, had another gifted director, Robert Wise, shoot additional footage, which Welles had nothing to do with, to fill in gaps in the narrative that were there because they had thrown away so much footage, and that film was released in a mutilated state. It failed at the box office, and that was the start of Welles's never-ending reputation as somebody who was profligate, who spent too much money, and who couldn't make movies that pleased audiences. He went on to make many, many other great films, movies that are very much audience pleasers, even if you see them now, movies like The Stranger and Touch of Evil. But he also made a lot of movies during the many, many years that he was based in Europe, which suffer from budgetary problems because, again, he kept running out of money, which are very great films nonetheless, great Shakespeare films like Macbeth and Othello, and Chimes at Midnight, which, by the way, I think is probably the greatest film he ever did make, his movie of Franz Kafka's novel, The Trial, various others, a very, very troubled career. So The Other Side of the Wind is this film which he shot. Now, what The Other Side of Wind is about, it is about a movie director near the end of his career who has a great big party to celebrate his having completed a film, or is still working on the film, actually, but he has a great big party for the first screening of his film, and there are all these people he knows who are there together, and the filmmaker is played. Welles thought about playing the part himself, but he eventually invited his friend John Huston, another very great filmmaker, although not nearly as great as Welles. He plays the role of this famous filmmaker who is the main character of The Other Side of the Wind. So what The Other Side of the Wind is a fake documentary, which is to say it's not really documentary, it's all fictional, but much of it improvised. This fake documentary about the making of a film called The Other Side of the Wind, and then bits of the finished film, The Other Side of the Wind, within this fake documentary. And that is what makes The Other Side of the Wind, which is the new Orson Welles movie that has just been completed all these years after his death. That may sound a little confusing, and the movie itself is pretty confusing when you look at it. It's leaping back and forth between this fake documentary stuff about the making of a film and then bits and pieces of that film shown here and there throughout, including, by the way, some pretty explicit sex scenes, unlike anything else Welles ever made during his long and fabulous career. But we do get to see John Huston playing a very major role, Peter Bogdanovich, the very fine filmmaker of a very different kind and a good friend of Welles's, plays a much younger filmmaker who was also involved in this, and all sorts of other famous faces show up in this film, which again is sort of a mixture of bogus documentary and footage from a film which was never really made. And all of this makes up The Other Side of the Wind, the new movie by Orson Welles. Now, interestingly, The Other Side of the Wind is having a theatrical release, but mainly it's been released on Netflix. So anybody who has access to Netflix can see the new Orson Welles film all these years after his death and make what they will of it. I certainly don't think it is one of Welles's better films. Many, many years ago, maybe something like 25 years ago, also some other filmmakers finished another film that was incomplete at his death, his movie of Don Quixote, based on the fabulous Cervantes novel. And that's pretty bad. At least the way it was assembled by these other filmmakers. And one of the troubles with The Other Side of the Wind is that Wells shot about 100 hours of footage for this movie, and the people who have now assembled the film after his death, you know, it's a two-hour movie. So they left out like 90 hours of footage which Wells shot. There could be many, many films made from the footage that Wells left behind. That's a whole other story. As it stands, I don't think it's one of Wells' greater films, and maybe somebody else, maybe someday somebody else will assemble an even better film from the footage that Wells left behind. In any case, also on Netflix, and with a tiny little theatrical release, is a new documentary by the very fine documentary director Morgan Neville called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is about the making of The Other Side of the Wind. It is a very, very informative and hugely entertaining documentary about Wells making The Other Side of the Wind, not completing The Other Side of the Wind, and the movie now being completed all these years later. So I totally recommend looking at The Other Side of the Wind, make of it what you will, but definitely look at the documentary, even if you don't look at The Other Side of the Wind. Look at They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, because it's a hugely entertaining look at a fabulous filmmaker, the very, very great Orson Welles. So that is my more or less documentary story this week, Joe.
Thank you so much, David Starrett. Films in Focus, the films Maria by Callas, Free Solo, The Other Side of the Wind, and They'll Love Me When I'm Dead.